I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Susan Aglukark joins me now. The legendary singer-songwriter will share the bill Sunday evening, the 12th of April, at the Chan Shun Concert Hall with acclaimed throat-singing duo Pilk Silk. Part of the Chan Center's Made in Canada series, this evening features Inuit artists who, on their own, have captivated Vancouver audiences previously. I'll ask Susan, who I spoke to earlier this week, about coming to Vancouver and her storied career. She was the first Inuk artist to ever win a Juno Award, and last year celebrated the 30th anniversary of her album, This Child, which featured the hit OCM. I'll ask her about her music and about writing and performing. Last year, she also released her memoir, Kihiani, co-written with our old friend Andrea Warner. That was released to great reviews. I'll ask Ms. Aglukark about her activism as well. As the founder of the Arctic Rose Project, she's worked to provide Inuit and Northern Indigenous youth safe spaces for arts and literacy programs. Visit chancenter.com for tickets and information. Since This Child, Susan Aglukark has gone on to write and record 10 albums and win 3 more Junos. Other than her memoir, she's authored 2 children's books and is an Officer of the Order of Canada and a recipient of the Governor General's Performing Arts Award for Lifetime Artistic Achievement. Visit SusanAglukark.com for more. Again, the concert is Sunday, the 12th of April at 7:30 p.m. We spoke this past Monday with Susan joining me from Oakville, Ontario. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Susan Aglukark. Ms. Aglukark, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. This concert on April 12th with Pilk Silk, what is it like to share the bill with them? Have you toured with them before?
I have not. We have shared festival spaces, Indigenous festival spaces, but our schedules don't necessarily align, so it's never been necessarily on the same day. But I know them, you know, Inuit Nunangat being what it is, and a great and very broad but very small community. It's an absolute pleasure to get a chance to do this work with them on April 12th.
They just seem to be taking off in a way that it's just wonderful to hear, you know, especially they're extremely talented, each of them.
They absolutely are, and I'm sure you've listened to their music, but when they first came out with this style of music that they were developing, I was so excited for young up-and-coming artists to watch all the possibilities.
So at this concert at the Chan Center on the 12th, will you, you'll each do a set, I assume, but will you be performing together at all?
No, we don't have any plans to perform together, only because there hasn't been any time to really develop or collaborate on anything. But I imagine when we're there that we'll probably find something that we can develop together.
I read somewhere, Susan, that you took up throat singing not too long ago. Is that correct?
I wouldn't call it took up. I did my 30th anniversary tour last year, 30th anniversary of the album This Child, and I brought on this tour with me a young up-and-coming Inuk singer-songwriter. And she was coaching me on throat singing, and it's really tricky to go from throat singing to, you know, contemporary singing, and that's been my challenge. But she was coaching me, so I haven't quite mastered it yet.
Well, you have two marvelous experts at it.
Absolutely.
Coming up in April, you'll be seeing here in Vancouver. You mentioned This Child, and OCM came out the year I was in grade 8, and it's one of those things where I remember hearing it all over the place that year that it came out. How does a song like that, a hit song especially, change your life?
Well, I think it's important to get the context. And when you read Kihiani, you'll get the context of where I came from and got to that point in 93, 94, and 95 when the record deal happened. I'm in the studio writing this debut album, and then from all of that is this surprise hit song that charts, and not only charts, but ends up number one. For me, at that time, who I was completely clueless. I understood that something important had just happened, And I loved the life that I found myself in. Mm. But I also was incredibly overwhelmed all the time because there is so much for me to figure out and to catch up with. And so I appreciated especially that my career had been launched by a song like OCM that comes from an Indigenous First Nations group on the West Coast. So it's not Inuktitut or even from my people, the Inuit. Hmm. It comes from a First Nations group and their language. But the learned discovered piece, the shared discovered piece being how similar the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis journeys have been and what we share in terms of ways of being and acknowledging the beauty of humanity. And that's really what OCM was about. And so to launch my career with something like that, I think that was the piece that I always appreciate the most about that song.
I read somewhere that it was inspired, some of the lyrics in OCM were inspired by, I guess you'd heard members of the Coast Salish speak at an event?
Yep. So back in the early years, 1993, this was just after the release of my first album, Arctic Rose, and we were starting some public speaking events, and I was at a conference in Banff, Alberta, and at the head table, and I'm like 23, 24 years old. What am I going to talk about? I've just started to live my life. And so I'm sitting there a little bit uncertain why I'm taking up this space. And then there's two gentlemen from the coast. I learned from the Coast Salish Nation. And they did this really beautiful thing. They set the tone of the room. They welcomed and honored guests, and they used words in their language, Haichka, Siemosiea. And I went later after that event to go and have a chat with them about this language and could I use these words in a song. And we had just signed the record deal with EMI, and I was starting to work with my producer, Chad Urshik, on the writing of the album. And so flying back to Toronto and in the studio in Toronto, started writing OCM from that event.
Really? Yeah. And performing it as you have over the last 30 years, does the song, I was going to ask you if it still means something. It obviously does, but it means a great deal to the audience, doesn't it? And, I mean, you can feel that when you're performing, don't you?
I do. And when we were doing the tour last year, you walk away. I was very, very proud of the 30th anniversary for one thing, mm-hmm. but then to have followers that came on board 30 years ago, and then to have them bring their adult children and a young teenage grandchild, all in the audience, all singing OCM, three generations touched by a song. And honestly, Joe, I think if there was one song that I feel is a favorite, it's always going to be OCM, because to this day, it still has that ability to, like a reset me into, this is not about celebrity, this is not about superstar path, this is this incredible gift you've been given, and appreciate that, and this resets me every time.
And it'll be, I guess, one of those songs that audiences will just, at the Chan Center on April 12th, will just delight in hearing. When you perform, a lot of these songs that are, 30 years old, some of them, what is it like for you? I mean, I think of a song like Kathy, mm-hmm. where you honor your niece's memory. Mm-hmm. I think of Still Running. These are obviously painful songs. What are they like to perform after all these years? I mean, a song like Still Running, for example. I mean, it's about a period in your life that was rather painful. You suffered abuse. Does writing a song like that and performing it as you have over the years, does it help with the trauma at all, or is it re-traumatizing at all?
Well, there's the complexity, right? So first of all, Kathy was a cousin, and no worries at all. Mm. But it's a little bit of both, Joe, because as Indigenous artists myself, Inuit First Nations Métis, when we do our keynotes, we talk about the trauma, and we must talk about the trauma, the historical trauma, the generational trauma, all of it. And talk about it because we need, and we have it now, so many lived and evidenced, if that is the right word, paths of healing, mm-hmm. in the telling of our stories and all of the story. We can't, and you'll read it in the book. There is a before and an after in our lives. And so I always say 100% of the Indigenous community has trauma. And we need to share them because then we're proof that given the right supports, we can get better. And we must, in fact. Tihiani is Inuktitut for because we must. And so we share because we have to. And the goal being the next generation's work to get better, to get whole, is not as heavy as our generation. But also, who I was when I moved to Ontario in 1989 and who I am today, I never imagined. I never imagined that I could be living this life that I love waking up to every morning. It's not perfect. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. But it's a choice I make every day. I get to make that choice. And those stories have to be told. And so in that way, getting to this place could not have happened had I not discovered songwriting and singing and creativity and expression through arts. I wouldn't be who I am today. So it's a clear but complex answer, because the more work we do, the more work we discover needs to be done, and it's going to be this way for some time in the Indigenous community.
And the thing about you that I admire and a lot of people admire is that despite it all, you remain optimistic about the future. I mean, that's clear in your work, not just as an artist, but, you know, as a citizen in terms of the Arctic Rose Foundation and all the things that you do throughout the country, that pretty rough times at the moment, and no doubt it'll get rougher. But for future generations, you do have a great deal of optimism, don't you?
I do, and I appreciate that. And back to the title of the book, Kihani, I have to. I have to. And I don't say that lightly. Have to doesn't simply mean, you know, it's not just the word I'm using. I think we do artist workshops as well. I say we because my husband works with me, and he handles the logistics, and he's a sound engineer by training, so he has that side of work. When we do workshops, we're brutally honest about the industry and the music industry and the public life work is brutal. Mm-hmm. We wake up every morning and we make the choice to keep doing this. And as long as up-and-coming artists are aware what to expect in terms of rolling up your sleeves and working hard every single day, I think those are important stories to tell, even when we tell them burnt out, and many of us do. I think telling these stories is important. We have a duty as Indigenous, quote-unquote, successful Indigenous artists to be brutally honest. And is that optimism? I suppose. But I think we're living in a time where we owe it to that generation to show them, to be evidence and proof of what's possible, but also how much hard work is required.
I know in the book you talk about burnout and having to contend with that, as you have throughout your career and at various moments in your life and your career. The idea of being a role model, the role of being a role model, has that been a burden for you?
Not a burden, never a burden, but it does get exhausting. Exhausting because there's always, we negotiate every day to live truthfully and honestly for yourself and for those who see everything and watch everything you do. And I'm at a point in my life where the pace that we have worked has caught up with us. So I find myself quite exhausted often. And I feel myself with a very short fuse, which I've never had before. Is this menopause? Quite likely. The age I'm at? Probably. But also, I get frustrated now because I think, I start to think, but I'm tired today. Can I just behave like a tired person, you know? Yeah. And so I hide. And so I find a private space that I hide. You just learn. Just learn how to cope with the changes that occur in your life and find the balance. But yeah, and there are days where I can't be anything but brutally honest today. And that's the risk you take. But yeah, you know, we do what we have to.
I think it'll surprise a lot of people, that you never really sought out to be a performer. I mean, you're a preacher's daughter. And so music is obviously, you know, performing at church, that, you know, but that wasn't a career choice for you, was it?
Not at all. No, it was just a series of happenstance opportunities, wonderful people crossing paths in those first couple of years. And even after Arctic Rose was released and before responding to major label calls in 93, I really thought that I could just tick off, you know, Arctic Rose record. Accomplished, took that off the bucket list and move on with the next stage of my life. I never imagined even then what it might be. And so, that's part of what I hope is what people read in the book is what I discovered when I made the choice to do this as a career, which was midway through the career. So we're talking to the early 2000s when I decided maybe you're a singer-songwriter and you should take this seriously. Mm. And I realized, why did it take so long? And part of the work we do now with the Arctic Rose Foundation is we didn't nurture dreamers. The way that the education system is set up in the North, maybe it's across the country, but I can only speak to our experience. Education absolutely is critical in setting you on a working path, a career path. But we must also balance it with nurturing dreamers, and we had none of that. We were deeply institutionalized. So I realized partway through the career that the more I did this, the more I fell in love with it, the more I felt hope in my body, the more I wanted to do this, that was the dreamer in me. And when I realized that, that became the goal. And I wanted to do this. I want to become a better singer. I want to become a better songwriter. I want to be an artist. And I think those are the stories that we have to share. And that's why the book.
You know, it's a wonderful thing to think about that you are still a performer of note, a singer, a songwriter, and the sort. But you do take the time. It's important for you to take the time to nurture the dreams of the young people, especially the young people in the North. One would think they'd be content, you know, working on their own stuff or doing their own career and making their own life. But nurturing the future, I mean, that's a priority, isn't it?
It is. And I really believe that hopelessness happens when they stop dreaming. Mm. And even if you're living the life you've built, even if your life's work is Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, we still have to nurture the dreamer in us. And so I think it's very important that we do the work we do. My husband and I were just up in Arctic Bay on the Baffin region. We just got back the other day from two other site visits, and the work our artists are doing at these sites is incredible to watch. The one we just did in Rankin Inlet, for example, was our artists, our dancers. There's two dancers on our roster, and And watching these youth freely move, and these are young boys and young girls, express themselves through movement, and the spark that awakens in them. I think this stuff is so important in the work we do in terms of mental health through expressive arts. I think that's why nurturing the dreamer through expressive arts is very important.
You talked a moment ago about happenstance, about luck and the chances that have come up in your life and career. Another thing of your life that I've admired is that it's how grounded you are. I mean, you're not impulsive. That you do think about these choices that are presented, and you know, I think of that phrase, you know, luck is a residue of design, and you're conscious of those around you, your parents, and where you're from, and that's always guided you in terms of, like, there's a, I can't wait to read this in the book, but there's a moment where you have to decide whether performing is going to be a career of yours, and you don't think, you don't go into it quickly, do you? I mean, you think about it carefully, don't you?
I do. I mean, I think of my parents often when I hit a burnout. And I touched on it briefly, actually not briefly, it is an important part of the story. Mm. When people understand, where my parents come from, they come from the land. So their birth and formative years was traditional. And then in their young years, they're coerced into settlement life, in the settlements we now have. All of my life has been in settlement, in contemporary Inuit settlements. And when I think back to what that must have been like for my parents, and then the life they built for us, and how incredibly, I don't like the word success in the context of my parents' story. They were incredibly focused. Mm. They built an amazing life for us in these small settlements. And so when I try to think of a word to describe my observation of the way our life was built in these environments, I think of the word compelled. They were ministers. My dad was an ordained minister. My mom is a self-taught academic, and she's constantly, she's 80 and she's still learning, constantly reading, and voracious writer and reader. And when I think of that compelled, how can I not be? Given these opportunities I've had these last 35 years, how do I not do my best when I think back on what that generation of Inuit gave up, and then were forced to do it. The word coerced is very strong in the book because that is what happened. So bilumakihia is the phrase I use in Inukshtut. I had to kihiani, I had to do and continue to do what I have to do, but I sure love it.
What did your mom think of the book?
She's good with it. She's good with it. There are moments there where there's a lot that happened in my life in this career that happened. It's part of my life. And, you know, sometimes she gets frustrated if I don't tell her every event I'm going to do. And I had to describe it to her as, Mom, think of it as this is my day job. You don't ask my other siblings to keep you posted on everything they do in their job. This is just my day job. So there's some things in there that she's read. She's like, you didn't tell me this. You didn't tell me that. It's just my life. You know, so there's a lot there that she learned about the public life of one of her children. And so aside from that, I think she really appreciated having parts of the family story told.
I'll bet, yeah. But it's just great to know that Susan Aglu Clark's mom is still a mom. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You know, she will call me. She calls all of us. You know, she talks to everything, and she'll say, somebody said this thing about, do you want me to correct it? Mom, I'm 60. I can handle things. Very cute.
Yeah, but you mentioned earlier in our chat about the 30th anniversary tour last year and seeing three generations of audience members. When you're performing, as you will shortly here in Vancouver, the minute you walk on the stage, I mean, did you feel the love from the audience?
Yes. Oh, my God. You know, the favorite story is in Saskatchewan. there was this hockey team. So Angela was my young Inuit artist that had joined us for this tour. Mm-hmm. And she goes in, out and does a couple of songs, and she comes off stage and she says, There's a whole hockey team in the front row, just so you know. So I said, okay, well, this will be interesting. Mm-hmm. So I get out there, and it was one of those venues that was an open bar venue.
Mm.
So you can see this hockey team, you know, going out and getting the next round and then and so on and so forth, and they get a bit rowdier and rowdier. And during the break, I got a message from the captain of the hockey team that he would love for me to do OCM. Because every time the team scored, they played OCM in the arena.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was one of those nights where we had to do OCM twice just because they were the show. I wasn't the show. They became the show. It was just so much fun to watch this hockey team there just simply for OCM. But they were all, like, the captain of the hockey team was such a big fan that he bought tickets for the whole team and told them, you have to go. You're coming to this concert. That was incredible.
Yeah, it is. I can't tell you, Susan, what a pleasure it is to talk to you today. I can't wait to read Kehani, and I guess I should tell you, break a leg for April 12th here in Vancouver. I so appreciate your time today. Thank you for this.
All right. Thank you so much, Joe.
The website for more is at susanaglukark.com. The concert with Pilk Silk is Sunday, the 12th of April, at the Chan Shun Concert Hall. That's part of the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at UBC. Visit chancenter.com for tickets. Susan Aglukark joined me on the line from Oakville in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.